The three didn't leave there much of a morning. Just as old the car and hit the bottom of the booth. Now, I don't blame him because he's running here, but the meanest thing that my daddy ever did was before he left, he went and made me soup. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from a lot of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle, and I'd turn red, and some guy'd laugh, and I'd bust his head. I tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue. But I grew up quick, and I grew up mean. My fist got hard, my wits got keen. Roamed from town to town to hide my shame. But I made me a vow to the moon and stars. I'd search the honky tonks and bars and kill that man and give me that awful name. Well, it was Gatlinburg in mid-July, and I just hit town and my throat was dry. Thought I'd stop and have myself a brew. At an old saloon on a street of...
A boy named Sue. The idea of that song is what we're going to talk about today, the influence that a father or the absence thereof has on his children. In particular, the influence it holds on a son. Byron Ricks will be with us. He's going to talk about his new book, Searching for Dad, and we'll be with Byron in just a few minutes. You are listening to BBS Radio. I'm Sherry Edwards, your host, and for the next hour, you're going to be listening to Sound Health. On this show, we attempt to bring you ideas and information to make your life a little brighter, your day a little sweeter, and above all, to support you in making informed decisions. The show is sponsored by the Sound Health Research Institute and the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology, where the sounds of your voice are seen as an indicator of your life and health, and where we believe that whoever controls your health controls your life, and we want that person to be you. Thank you for taking the time to join us. We have, I guess, one announcement, but it's kind of long before we start the show. As you know, we offered a free vocal profiling computer program called NanoVoice, and an incredible number of you have taken advantage of that offer and the free manual, but some of you complained about a long front page, so we revised it. So we're going to be taking that site down in a few days for the revision, so you won't need to jump on that if you want that program. I've developed a new database for it, for leadership and one for relationship compatibility. It's a great way to put a committee together or just to see what might come up with a partnership or a dating couple. We're also developing an online site that you can visit and get an online evaluation. We should have that completed in September. And it'll be exciting to see this work presented to the world. I love the idea. The NanoVoice program likely won't tell you things you don't already know, but it can certainly help you make the right decisions when you are ambivalent about how you feel or unsure about the direction you want to take in your life. So if you want to download the program, the old version is still up, probably will be the first part of next week. It's Nano, N-A-N-O, voice, just like you're talking, nanovoice.org. You go down to the bottom and you'll see this little floating nano voice, kind of blue, looks like a wave on an ocean. You click that and it'll download the program. We don't even need your email address. We'd like you to call and talk to us, but we really don't need it because we want this program to be absolutely free. We feel so strongly that people need this to start help evaluating their lives that it's absolutely free. And I know people don't believe that nothing in life is free, but that certainly is. And remember, we have a free class that you can sign up for to learn how to use it. The class is pre-recorded, or there's another one that you can watch. Well, that one you can watch anytime, but there's another one that's live. So either way, recorded or live, the class is there for you to learn how to use the program. Just mail class, C-L-A-S-S, class at vocalprofiling.com to select a time and date to participate. And for those of you who want to lose weight or join our anti-aging projects, you can also email us at that same address, class at vocalprofiling.com, or call us in Ohio Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 Eastern Time at 740-698-9119, or you can always write to us at radio@vocalprofiling.com. Okay, that was kind of a long announcement. This is several little short ones. Welcome to the show, Byron.
Thank you. Thank you, Sherry. Appreciate it.
Thank you for being with us. Byron Ricks is the author of Searching for Dad.
Yes.
About his own life. And would you share a bit of the idea behind the book with our audience? We have a pretty savvy audience.
Okay. The idea behind the book was to connect with those men who have grown up without a father, and or maybe the father was there physically but not connected with that son. And it's for those men who, for whatever reason, are estranged from their children, especially their boys. And then for women who are raising boys without a father or a male role model or a surrogate in his life, helping them to understand the psychological and personal challenges and physical challenges that that child has, and emotional challenges. And I had not read a book that covered those aspects of a youth, of a young boy growing up. I've read a lot of books that talked about the criminal elements of boys and girls growing up without fathers in their lives, but no one had gone all the way back, at least I hadn't read it, to where you look at the emotional and psychological challenges that that boy has that then causes those problems in later years.
It's a very readable, very poignant book. I have lots of questions, and I have a young man, a 25-year-old father, in the audience, in the studio with us, and his name is Eric, and he has some questions, but I have some questions, too, and he'll jump in because his life has been harder, and he's a very loving father. I have watched him with his kids, so he didn't pass that on. But
okay.
Your mother told you your father was dead, but you found out different.
Yes, when he showed up.
Do you think a dead father is worse than an absent father?
Oh, do I think a dead father? No, no. I think you may a boy may experience some of the same anxieties, but you know, if the father is dead, somehow as you grow older, you come to grips with life and death, as it were, and life as it is. But when the father is absent, he's alive and not active and not involved, you know, that's what gives you the feeling of not being valued, and that's where the void and the anxiety comes in. So, no, I don't think it's worse to be dead. I think it's worse to be absent.
You even talked about just a little bit ago that a father even living in the house can be absent.
Yes.
So many different kinds. What do you think the intention of your mother was in telling you that your dad was dead?
You know, I can only second guess. I just think, you know, we have to think of the era, you know, and my mom and the time. I think that it was just something that she didn't want to deal with at the time. I think that she believed in her heart that she could raise me on her own. I believe that she felt, and I know that the type of mom I had, she had gotten herself into this mess, as it were, and she could get herself out of it, and she was just being responsible for her own situation. And I think she wanted me not to have to go through what I eventually went through when I learned that he was alive.
How old were you then?
When I learned that he was alive?
Yeah, when he approached you on the street and told you he was your dad.
Oh, I had to be about 4 to 5 years old.
Okay, this is really a question maybe for something you've learned along the way, or maybe from your mother's perspective, but do you believe a bad husband equals a bad dad?
Yes. This is all biased answers, of course, but, but absolutely. I don't know how you can be a good dad and be a bad husband, because see, part of being a good dad is being a good husband, because your son learns from you. I was on a show not long ago in Atlanta, and the question was posed, when does a father begin to teach his son about sex? And I said, well, what you have to understand is that at the point that young man and young woman becomes cognizant of the relationship between their parents, that is when the sexual education begins. And so a good father, that's a good role model, will show the intimacy and the love to his wife, and his son and daughters learn from that. So I don't believe you can be a poor husband and be a good father.
You have kids now?
I do. I have two.
Two girls?
I have a girl and a boy.
One girl, one boy.
One boy, and I have a boy that's 25 years old. So I can, and he has a 2-year-old. So I can relate to the young man that's in the audience.
How do you think a mother's pain can be balanced with a boyhood without a father?
A mother's pain in
your lost boyhood without your father, because it was obvious, you know, in the book you talk about, she said that he lied and he lost all of his rights and go away and don't ever come back.
Right.
So I don't really know what that was about, but obviously she was in pain.
She was in pain, but what that was about, you see, as you read further in the book, you realize that I was a child that was born out of wedlock, and so the pain was that she didn't know. At least she maintains that she didn't know that he was married at the time, and so that was the lie that she was referring to, and so at that point, she realized it could not be a relationship with her and my dad, and so she chose to go to another state, another city completely, and start a new life with us.
Okay, let's say parents are not married, but neither one of them, they're not married to eat. I'm having difficulty forming this question. If there's a situation where there's a couple and they have a child and the father leaves because the mother just found the situation intolerable, do you think it would be better for the mother just to tolerate that situation just so the boy could have a father? I mean, how do you solve that?
Well, I understand that if you are in a household where there's conflict, where there's negativity, it impacts the child. So I'd much rather have the couple not be together. And yet, because they're not going to be able to pretend, it's just not going to happen. And I know that, you know, a lot of the Christians who hear this would just cringe at this because you stay together for the kids. But I think it would be better for them not to be together as husband and wife or boyfriend and girlfriend, whatever they are, as a couple, but yet understand the need of the child to have both of them in their lives. And so, therefore, from that point on, they must then plan their activities and involvement as it relates to the betterment of that child.
Okay, personally, I don't believe that they should stay together if it's not a good relationship, because it just perpetuates
exactly
that bad idea of what a marriage and a loving family is.
Exactly. I agree with that 100%.
So I'm on your side here.
Okay.
Do you think it's worse being fatherless for a boy than it is for a daughter?
Goodness gracious, I've gotten that question so many times. And I'd even had people ask me, well, what about girls? Or how come you didn't write about girls? And I thought, you know, and my wife grew up fatherless, you know. I don't think it's worse. No, I think that it's different. And I didn't write about that because, again, I'm not a female, so I didn't know what they felt, and I didn't want to presume to. And then the research that it would have taken, I think I'd still be writing the book. It took long enough as it was. But I don't think it's worse. No, I think any time you have a parent missing in a child's life, whether it be the mother or the father, I think you're going to have a void in that child's life.
Couldn't you persuade your wife to write this other part of this book?
You know, she said that the other day. We saw a documentary on girls and pregnancies and the prenatal care. And she said, you know, I think I need to help you write that sequel.
I am very, very lucky. My dad was a bigamist and deserted our family right before I was born. But I was adopted by a great family. And do you think a stepdad can ever take the place of the biological dad?
You know, I've talked to people who have been, young men who have been adopted, and I have I've gotten some who have said they did not miss, had no desire to connect with their biological father. The father they had is indeed their father, and they're content with that. I've had others to say that they were content with their adopted father, but yet they had this innate yearning to at least connect with the biological father so that they can somehow close the loop on their identity. So I think that to answer your question, it depends on the mindset of the boy or the girl who's adopted, where they are in their life. And again, the family can be totally loving. You have two kids that are adopted with totally loving families, but yet it's that innate desire that's different in each of them.
I've done some interviews with some people in preparation for this show, and one of the big things is that the parents remember the situation differently. The one parent will say, she wouldn't let me visit, and the other parent will say, he wouldn't visit. You know, that's kind of an issue. I want to ask Eric a question here. You've had an adopted father, and you've had your biological father that you have more relationship with now that you're grown. When you were with your adopted father, did you crave your biological father at all? Did you think something was missing?
I'm not so sure that my stepdad and my biological father are. I don't think either one of them are the complete example. Both of them were good examples of some things and not of others. But yeah, I did crave to be around my biological father, even though that my stepfather was there for me in many ways.
So there's still that lost connection of the biological dad, like Byron was saying. Byron, this experience of growing up without a dad, how do you think it changed your life? Are you willing to share that with the audience? It might be a bit painful.
I think that, I think it made me, this is almost, I think it, you know, again, it's a tough question. But somehow I think it made me a better person. And then you say that, and automatically you go to, people should grow up without dads. No, I don't advocate that at all. But I think that I was just that unique or individual person in that I so much longed for my father and what he didn't do that I made a commitment in my life to be everything that he wasn't. And so when I say I think I'm a better person now, I think because of how I approach that obstacle, how I approach that adversity. I approached it from a perspective of not a victim, but woe is me, but I said, let me become a conqueror. Let me become a better man than my father. And so I knew all the things that my father didn't do, and so that gave me the roadmap of things that I should do that he didn't to in my life and in my children's lives. So I think that's how it impacted me. And I also, you know, I did have a very strong mother, and my mother would tell me how a man should act and how a man should behave and things a man should do, and she would tell me the difference between a boy and a man. As the chapter in the book talks about males, you know, men and males.
Tell us that difference. What's the difference between a man and a boy?
Well, the major difference between a male, okay, and again, it's not necessarily boy, but a male and a man, because we are born male. You know, you're born female. You have no control over that. But you become a man or you become a woman based on your values, based on your life's experiences, based on your beliefs. And the major difference between a male and a man is discipline. A man has more discipline than a male. a man understands he has this ego, but he also is able to take that ego and put it in check, whereas males aren't. Men understand that humility does not make them weak, but instead it makes them strong. And they don't need to show their power because they understand that their power is appreciated by being humble and by just being the men that they are. Whereas, again, males, it's always a showboat. It's about me. It's always showing you how strong I am, how fast I am, how much better I am, you know, the respect that I'm due. You know, men don't have to tell you that they're due respect. They garner respect just by their attitudes and their behaviors.
This is probably a long list, but can you give me some real competent, integral responsibilities of a father?
A father, first of all, takes responsibility for his actions. Fathers are not perfect, but they take responsibilities for their actions. They take responsibility for their kids. Fathers are loving. Fathers spend time with their kids, and that time is not based on grades or it's not a reward. It's because they love them and they show them the value. Fathers hug their kids, and I did a seminar today, and I asked the question, how many of you, if your fathers ever said, I love you? And it was amazing. I had a room of 50 people, and 70% of the men in the room, hands went up. You know, a father tells his son, I love you, and spends time with him, takes responsibility for him, and have patience with that boy. You know, because that father understands that that boy is rough and tumble. That boy is unlike his daughter in that, you know, boys don't learn the same way girls do. We are rough and tumble. It's not that classroom learning is not for us as a whole. Not that we can't learn in the classroom, but we appreciate, as John Eldridge say, the rough and tumble and the wild at heart. And a man understands that, and he's not threatened by his son. In fact, he is able to foster a sense of self-esteem and self-respect in his son. That's what fathers do. Men become threatened, non-responsible fathers become threatened by their sons, and they want to harness their energy, and they want to control them, and that's not what fathers do.
Do you have any advice for the really young parents that maybe had a baby incredibly young and just couldn't socially be responsible? How do you deal with that?
I think that, you know, it's not a shame not to know. It's nothing to be ashamed of not to know or not to have experience. What you do is you find someone, a mother, a grandparent, a aunt, or a surrogate, or someone in the neighborhood, someone in the church, someone in some social group, someone in that circle who indeed has had the experience, and you go to them, and hopefully they can become a mentor for you to help you raise that child and help you understand what a parent, a young parent, needs to know in order to be a good parent for that child. So, you know, ask for help.
I was talking about some kids in high school. Would you just suggest they give their baby up for adoption so it can have loving parents that really wanted it, could handle the situation?
Well, then we're assuming that the high school kid doesn't love the kid. And I think that not love the kid is one thing. Not to be mature enough to raise it is something different. I think that if indeed you don't feel that you can give that child what it needs, then adoption is an option. But if you are just not mature enough and not experienced enough, but you have all the love in the world for that child, then I think a mentor is another option to help you bring that child home. Because understand this, that child that you give up for adoption someday is still going to look for you. It's still going to want to connect with you. But all else being said, if you're in a situation where you just cannot take care of the child, then the child's present well-being is more important than what it may want in the future.
I realized after I met my mother when I was older that it took a tremendous amount of love and courage for her to give me up.
Yes.
Did you have a father figure in your life?
No, not really.
Do you think mothers should seek that kind of relationship out for their son? You were talking about in the church or school.
I think that it's a good idea, you know, if you can, if there's an uncle, a grandfather sometimes fills that role, you know, an older brother or some male that you trust and believe in that can actually stand in as a surrogate. You see, no man will ever be a boy's father, and that's the challenge we have of this situation when the father's not there, because you don't want to come in and try to be the father or pretend to be the father for that son, but you want to be a male role model for him that demonstrates the characteristics of manhood such that he can understand that, see what that is, and mimic that. But it's a tedious, careful training that you must be prepared to do and give, and not be a father, but be a man in his life such that he can understand what a man is and what a man does.
Do you think that mothers ought to be obligated to remarry to supply that father figure?
No. I don't think mothers should be obligated to be married at all. I think mothers still have a relationship. They still have a life, and I think that they need to marry for love. But I think here's the thing that happens for women as well, and men as well, because I have friends who are raising their kids without moms. You know, they talk to me. You didn't write a book about us. We have a problem too. What about us? We're good dads. But I think that, you know, what you look for in a mate is a little different when you have a kid, because you have to look for a mate that understands that you have a kid and also understands what that kid needs, and more importantly, be willing to provide the kid's needs as well as the needs of you as that spouse.
I know you do workshops and lectures. Is this the kind of thing that you teach?
Well, we teach a few things in our workshops, because, again, we have several audiences. We have that audience who has grown up without their father in their lives regularly, or maybe with their father, and they have experienced the side effects, that one of anger. I talked to a young man today, and he said, "I'm still angry." So we deal with those guys who are still angry with their fathers. They're still estranged from their fathers. They know them. They maybe talk with them every now and then. We deal with that group of people so that they can get over those side effects. And then we deal with a group of people who are divorced and estranged from their kids. And I try to teach them that all your kids are equally yours. And so how do we fight through the angry mama drama so that we can have a relationship with the kid and show the kid that we love them and they are valued? And so that's the other group that we deal with. And then another group we deal with are those who are with their sons, or with their daughters, and they say, "I want to make sure that I am being the best father that I can be." And so we go through parenting skills for them to make sure that they understand what it takes to be a good father. And then we're working with moms who are raising boys. We haven't gotten there yet, but that's what we're headed toward.
You're listening to BBS Radio, and if you have a question for our guest, the toll-free number in the U.S. is 877-876-5227, and in Canada, and it also works in the U.S., 888-815-9756, the direct number, 530-876-3222, and I will be monitoring. Oh, didn't mean to do that. I just hit a button on my computer to monitor the email. We do have some questions coming in from the audience. Our audience likes emails. Okay, this question. Byron is answering a lot of questions for me personally. I love that you have this guest and this topic. Here's my question. As a mother of two boys without their father around, is there any way to make their father a better dad?
I don't know of a way to influence their father and make him a better dad.
Can't he come to your workshop?
That would be great. Outside of him wanting to be a better dad. I mean, it really starts with him wanting to be a better dad than it does you doing anything to make him a better dad. He has to want to be it. And at that point, then, you know, it's sort of like I went when I, in my practicum, my graduate studies in human behavior, and it was amazing when I went to a practicum and an AA meeting, and they stand up and say, "My name is Byron Ricks, I'm an alcoholic," if you will. And each time they stand up, they'd say that. And after the practicum, I asked the facilitator, "Why do they always have to say that?" And he said that they have to admit and understand what they are, what the problem they have, before they can heal and before they can do anything about it. And so this father has to first understand that he is not living up to his obligations as a father. Forget his obligations as a husband to you now. That's gone. That's over with. But his obligations as a father. And if somehow you can get him to understand that his boys need him in their lives and want him in their lives, then he will and can become a better father. But outside that, I don't know any other way other than my workshop.
You met your dad once when you were, like, six. Did you ever meet him again?
I met my dad when he came. I was like about maybe 5 or 6. I saw him again when I was 13 years old, and I probably spent the most time with him then. I seen him again at 17, 18 or 19, and 22.
Is he still alive?
He is still alive, yes.
Are you want to cultivate a relationship with him?
No. Do I want to? I would like to if it presented itself, but I'm no longer needing that in my life. You know, and again, I talked about that in the book, Side Effects and How to Overcome Them. I've overcome that need to connect with him. I've accepted life as it is now, and I moved on.
How did you do that?
Well, I did it through my faith, you know, through what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in a power greater than me. And so when I began to rely and believe in that power and operate within that power, then that took the need away from me to connect with him. Because, you see, I have to accept the reality of what may never be, because he doesn't want it to be that way. Or I can lament in that and, you know, be angry in that and unforgiving. So I've forgiven him through my faith, allowed me to do that, and move on with my life. It is what it is. And I have a rich, beautiful, full life. I can't, you know, be hung up on that.
Do you think somebody ought to write an instruction booklet when the baby's born?
You know what? If there was a parenting booklet that would fit everyone, I'd be on an island. I'd be richer than Bill Gates. You know, because you can write a booklet, but it doesn't fit every situation. You know, I have two children, and they are as different as night and day. And it amazes me. I have to sit back just not long ago, and I looked at my son, and I said, you know, I'm learning things about him that I didn't know about him growing up. I had my daughter first, and she was a certain kind of kid, and I had my son. I expected he'd be that way. And I thought, well, you know, I made these mistakes with this kid. Let me do something different with that kid. Well, some of that worked. But the other parts of it didn't work for that kid at all. It was a whole different kid.
Like, surprise.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
There's a very poignant story. It doesn't have anything to do with dads. In your book about your monkey. Would you share that with our audience?
Oh. Well, when I grew up, I was born in Alabama, and my brother is 17 years older than I was, and so I didn't really grow up with, you know, any siblings. I didn't have anybody, and my mom, I don't know who gave me this monkey, to be honest with you. I don't know where the monkey came from, but they gave me a monkey, and that monkey favored Curious George. I'm dating myself now. Some people say, Curious George, what kind of monkey is it? And it was a monkey, and I'd had it over the years. It had one eye. And you punch the chest, and it made this sound. And I would carry that monkey with me, and I would talk to that monkey, and that monkey would soothe me, and it would comfort me. And it just, you know, gave me rest. It gave me peace. And we got to Chicago, and I had this monkey. Now, my mother said I'd had that monkey since I was a kid, so that means this monkey had to be about 6 years old by the time, you know, this story happened in Chicago. That's a lot of years for a monkey, a stuffed monkey for a kid. And it was raggedy, and it was old, but it was my favorite toy, and I loved it dearly, and it just gave me solace. I couldn't go to sleep that night without it. And my mother, one day was at home, and she decided to clean up, because I had so many toys. And she decided to clean up and throw some of those toys away because they all wouldn't fit in the toy box. And she discarded my monkey. And I came home from school, and my monkey was gone. And I felt like someone had just ripped my best friend from my heart. And it just tore me up. You know, I lost my father in my mind. I lost my monkey. Here I am, devastated at, you know, 5, 6 years old. Everything that I loved dearly and that was close to me was gone. Now, Sherry, here's the key. Here's something that I want to share with your audience. Let's fast forward. Because this monkey impacted me, and the snatching of this monkey impacted me so greatly. Let's fast forward. I'm married. I'm living in California, and I had won a cup at the fair in California. And it was a plastic cup with some kind of logo on it, and I put it in my bathroom, and I put my toothbrush and toothpaste in it. You know, and I had this cup several years to the point that the logo had begun to wear off the cup. My wife, in her infinite wisdom, and she loves to decorate the house, she's an HGTV fanatic, she went to buy some things for the bathroom, and she replaced my cup with a nice, new, shiny glass, porcelain, whatever it was, toothbrush cup, and it matched everything, soap dishes. And I came home, and my cup was gone. And I asked her, "Where's my cup?" And she said, "Oh, I threw that old raggedy thing away. It was getting old, and it was, you know, worn." And I had a temper tantrum. Because at that moment, I felt the same way I did when my mother had taken my monkey. But yet, when I was attempted to have a temper tantrum with my mother stopped it in its tracks, because that just didn't happen when I grew up. You know, I grew up in the era where, you know, it was legal to beat your kids.
So it sounds like it was a point of comfort.
It was an absolute point of comfort.
In both of them.
And understand, but see, this is the thing, that baggage I kept with me until my adulthood, and it showed up, and we talk about this in our workshop, it showed up in my marriage over a stupid plastic cup. And my wife could not understand why I would be so emotional over a cup. And it really wasn't the cup. It was the monkey.
Yeah, it was your old tape.
Exactly. The old tape playing it in this relationship. And that happens.
Eric has a question for you. When she made you give up the monkey, did it send you backwards in your development, or did it force you to go forward and get some courage, or whatever you want to put this in a different way?
There's a poster on the wall on the way in here. It's Yoda. It says, "Train yourself to do without the things you fear to lose."
Right.
And I wondered if maybe losing the monkey was a trauma, but at the same time, did it make you grow? Did it make you a better person?
I don't know. I think it made me understand that life changes, and there are changes in life that you cannot control. And it made me understand that you must adapt to life as it comes. And so I never had another toy that I attached myself to in that way, because I understood that you could lose it.
Wow. We have about 10 minutes left. I want to ask Eric one question, and I want to come back and ask you about the side effects of being fatherless that you... It's in the back of your book, and I think it's wonderful.
Okay.
I think everybody should buy this book. It has so much in it that's just more than being fatherless.
Yes.
But, Eric, one of the things that you went through that Byron didn't is that you now have a relationship with your biological father.
Yeah.
How is that different from your adopted father that raised you? I know one of the things that you said to me this afternoon when we were preparing for the show is that your biological father has now become the child.
Hmm.
Is that a difficult question? If you don't want to answer, you don't have to.
Well, it's not that it's a difficult question. It was a long one, and it's hard to make the beginning bit to the ending bit.
The difference between your relationship with your adopted father now and your biological father, and then I'm going to ask you about how that affected you as a father yourself. But what's the difference? When you gained a relationship with your biological father, was it very different from your adopted father that raised you?
They're two very different people. I had someone in my life when I was younger that taught me to take away the positive things from people and try not to emulate a positive behavior and not a negative behavior.
You talking about your grandpa?
I was talking about you.
Oh geez. Okay.
I learned to take the positive aspects of both of them, because like you were saying in the book, you talk about being rough and tumble, and that's how you learn. My stepfather wasn't that way. He was a computer geek. I mean, and that's all well and good. That's the way he likes to be, and he's comfortable with that. And he was able to teach me many things. He's made me a smarter person. His control and his calm I took away from him. And then on my genetic father's side, I think his lack of control made my stepfather's control seem even more important. Maybe it was I was able, between the two of them, to come out, I believe, ahead. I know that some of the problems, it's the back of the book, the way you list them, I can agree with them, and a lot of them I have not dealt with, but a lot of them I've been gifted good ways to get around them.
I noticed you treat your two boys very differently from either of your fathers I've seen you interact with. You get down to the floor and play with them. You are down to their level. You teach them by example. And how'd you learn how to do that without those parenting skills being used with you?
That question is to Eric?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Byron. Did you have a question, Byron?
No, I didn't know if you were asking me or Eric that question. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was asking him that question.
Okay, and I'm listening.
And then I'll ask you that question.
Okay.
I have a bunch of babies, and some of it's been trial and error. And
when you say a bunch of babies, how many babies do you have?
I have 5 children at this time.
Okay.
But a lot of the things that I had to learn, I could do my best with and hope for the best and see what got the greatest return, what got them to act closer to what I hoped, you know,
right.
What would make them make good decisions, to
right.
think carefully about things.
Right.
One of the biggest impacts was when my oldest daughter, her name's Jackie, when she first emulated me, it was the moment that I became a father. When I could see her behaving the same way that I behaved.
Yes, yes.
I knew that
it changes
it was,
you, doesn't
it?
It
was that important. I had to
yeah.
do something with my behavior right
yeah.
now, because
right now.
She decides what man she wants to be with.
Yes.
Is the example that I give her.
Yeah, you set the bar.
And then it happened again.
Yes.
When the boy was born, because I have 3 girls and then 2 boys. When my boy was born, it wasn't I need to show her what to look for. It was I need to show him what to be.
Yes.
It was. I don't know how I've got here. I attribute a lot of it to just a good way of looking at things.
You respond to their children on their level, and
yeah.
that's one of the things I love about your relationship with them. And that's why I asked you to come on this show, because the way you were raised from both directions is certainly not who you are.
Right.
Brian, does your experience affect the way you treat your babies? Well, they're grown up now.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's just an easy question for me. I did for and gave my kids everything that I didn't have. And so I knew what I wanted as a kid. I wanted my dad to ride bikes with me. I wanted him to play catch with me. I wanted him to take me to games. I wanted him to coach my teams. You know, I wanted him to do those things with me. And that's what I did for my son. That's what I did for my daughter, the things that my father didn't do for me. So for me, it was just easy. It was just really easy to do the things for them that they that my father didn't do for me.
Because it's what you wanted.
It's what I wanted.
I agree with that.
Okay.
I went a lot on the pain that I felt coming from my father.
Right.
I don't want them to experience
right.
this pain.
Yes.
How do I insulate them from
yes.
this pain?
Right. Absolutely.
I should tell you, Eric's my grandson.
Oh, is that right?
And
okay.
When he was small and his mother and father were separated because there was a lot of violence in the family.
Right.
And I used to beg his father to come and see him. I used to offer to take him to his father.
Yes.
And now his father remembers it as if we would not allow him to see Eric. And there's just such a different story. I think he really believes that that happened, the father, the biological father. So there's no convincing him that reality is any other way. And
right.
I think that's one of the things, if you can open those kinds of things up in your workshop, I think that would be incredible for parents.
You know, there's this concept that's called gallows humor. And gallows humor is jokes that are made out of tragedy situations or tragic situations such to lighten them so you don't have to deal with them. And that's one of the things that bio fathers do. It's easier to live with she wouldn't let me, they wouldn't let me, than it is to live with I didn't do, and I could have.
So
that's
it's easier for him.
With.
Oh, I see what you're meaning. Okay, change your reality.
Right, right. See, I can talk to, because all absentee fathers, well, at some point, if an absentee father's still alive and that kid, you know, connects with them, they're going to have, as I talk about in that book, they're going to have the conversation, and they're going to have the why question. All kids are going to ask, why weren't you there? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? Why didn't you do the other? And it's hard to sit there and say, well, I don't know. But it's easier to say, well, I tried. But your mother this, your grandparents this, your aunts this, your uncles this, the law this, the courts that. So it's easier. It's an easier reality if I change it than to face that kid with the truth, I just messed up.
Oh, in this case, I think the couple was just too young to ever be, I don't want to say decent, but responsible parents. They just didn't know how. They didn't. They were
too
young.
But then say that. Just say to your son, I'm sure Eric would have appreciated, you know, Eric, I could have and should have done those things, but I was X amount years old. I was 20-some years old, and I just was stupid.
Actually, they were 15 and 17.
Okay, then that's more the reason to say it.
I believe that I try not to hold anger towards my father.
Right.
I believe that he was shorthanded with his father. His father might have been there, but like you were speaking about earlier, he was absent.
Right.
He was there, but he didn't do the things that were necessary for him to understand how to be a man.
But then at 17, he's a boy.
Yeah, I can't hold it against him.
Right.
That
you've been 17, Eric. I've been 17. I would not want kids at 17, would you?
No.
No.
So in the back of your wonderful book, Searching for Dad, which is at Amazon, guys. It's not been rated yet, but I'm going to send in a rating.
Oh, thank you.
In the back of this book is 9 side effects of being fatherless. Can
right.
you cover those in about 4 minutes? Because that's all the time we have left.
I can cover some of them. How about that?
Okay.
One, and Eric might be able to attest to this, is the crisis of identity, the identity crisis. Yes, Eric had a... surrogate father who was, you know, nice to him. In other words, he wasn't an abusive father, but yet he still felt that need to connect with his biological father, because we have this crisis of identity when that father is not there. Who are we really? And we need to connect with that bloodline. And that's one of the crises that we deal with, or the side effects, is this identity crisis. And then one Eric touched on, he said, I try not to be angry with my father. And that's another side effect, is that anger that grows and builds in us as we get older. I was talking to a gentleman today, and this guy was 50 years old. His father has long passed, and he's still angry. You know, and that's one of the side effects. And we deal with that side effect and in the workshops, and we help them, overcome and get through that. And then it's a void there. Something is always missing. You know, that's another side effect. What is that void? And that void of not having dad, not having the bonding, not having the connection is there. And so we do things to try to fill the void, because the void is really pain. You know, and then not feeling valued, because what we understand about value is things that are valuable, people protect them. They put them in safe deposit box. They put them in places where people can view them and see them. They take care of them, and they spend time with them. And that's how value is judged, by where you spend your time. So if your father isn't spending any time with you, then you don't feel valued. So those are four that, you know, right off the top, I have talk with men all over the United States of America, they've concurred that those are side effects that they feel as well.
And if somebody wants to get in touch with you, Byron, how can they do that?
www.byronricks, one word, byronricks.com. And you can always Google Byron Ricks. I'll pop up.
Well, I was going to cover this lopsided view of sex and not enough love. There's so much in this little book.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely incredible. It's $17.95 on sale at Amazon. In your present life, you're an inspirational speaker on the topic of interpersonal communication. And yeah. I think your experience... Did you have a question?
I just wanted to make sure I got this comment in, that I could not have done this by myself. Without my very strong wife, Amy, I would be as off as my own father.
Thank you for that.
That's really excellent.
That is. And I concur with that. If you read the book, at one point in the book, my anger overwhelmed me, and I talked about taking a baseball bat and just going to my father's house and beating him upside the head. And it was my wife who... It stopped that and helped me to understand that I needed to move on with my life. And she, in many ways, is the impetus for this book. So, Eric, I concur.
There's not many times, always an exception. But I was a young parent, and I did the best I could, and I made a lot of mistakes. And
yes.
I didn't do anything to deliberately hurt my children.
No.
But I know that there's things I did that was a detriment to them.
Right.
And you can only say you're sorry because you can't change history. But I think you can change lives with the workshops that you present, and I would encourage people to get in touch with you. 1 minute left. How are people responding to your book? Are they writing to you, or are they...
Oh, again, if you go to the website and check the book out, they're writing to me. They're calling me. And, one of the things that's happening with the book, I never imagined this, really. I have people who are buying the book and they'll read it, and then they'll order 5 copies or 6 copies or another 2 copies because they want to give them as gifts, And I've had people read it, and they say, I had a father and I had an adjusted family, but I know somebody who needs to read this.
Can they get this from your website, too?
Yes, you can buy it through the website. The ones through the website are autographed. I will autograph those. The ones through Amazon.com, I can't, because they already have their inventory.
Thank you for being on the show. There's lots more questions. I didn't get back to the email. There's questions about people want to know what an angry mama is. I just tell them, go buy the book.
Yes, yes.
Searching for Dad, Brian Hicks.
Byron Ricks.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
And for our audience, thank you for listening. Thank you, Byron, for being with you. And we'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Hopefully I can get a copy of this.
Yes, we can get that to you.
Thank you.
And I think about it now and then, every time I cry, and every time I win, and if I ever have a, well, if I ever have a boy, I'll name him Frank or George or Bill or Tom or anything, but Sue, I don't want him going around here calling Sue all his life. That's a horrible